Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for June 20th, 2019, and goodness, is time flying once again. A few topics I'll be talking tonight about: Nigeria and the population growth there. It is unbelievable, the amount of population, and some of these fun facts that go along with that, like they will have to produce in the early 2020 timeframe, which is basically right now, 100,000 jobs per week to keep up with the population growth. Now, imagine that in a small country, African country, to somehow manage 100,000 jobs, new jobs created per week, just to keep up with the population growth within the country. Wow. I'll be talking about fracking, the end of fracking, which nobody wants to talk about. I will be talking about on this show. I'll be talking about corn to fuel, biofuel, what Trump has done recently, and creating business where there were really limited business opportunities before. And then I'll be talking about the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is now 10 years orbiting the moon, giving us very little real information, and then some other scientific topics. And then the main science topic, I'll be talking a little bit of a segue into my paid cast. Now, excuse me, if you remember, I'm starting my paid cast in June. It's already started. Dealing with educational systems, and the next 100 paid casts will be for literally creating an educational system that people can use. But first of all, you have to understand where our current educational system came from, what's wrong with it, and then how to fix it. So I'll be talking about segue into that, but I'll be talking about a real topic, which involves the following. Evolution is taught as a science fact, as if it's just kind of like global warming. There's this universal scientific agreement, therefore it must be true, kind of like popular vote science. And that's not how science works. If you remember, I don't think anybody remembers back in Galileo's day, but if you read about it, Galileo was the guy who invented science the way we see it today. In other words, scientific experiment, it has to be what rules the day, not opinion. And so the way physics was taught was Aristotelian. I mean, the Aristotelians, the Greeks did a tremendous amount, the Euclideans, etc., did a tremendous amount of work in, say, mathematics and geometry and understanding bisecting a line or equilateral triangles, or, you know, various properties of triangles, the area of a triangle, other, you know, the other formulas that are very simple, the right triangle formula, the a squared plus b squared equals c squared. They proved that using boxes and squares in geometry. So anyway, but going back to Aristotle and the Greeks, there was a belief that a bigger ball, say made out of the same material like lead or iron, a bigger ball would fall faster because it was bigger, and that's the way it was taught for thousands of years. There was consensus. That's what according to Aristotle, that was like gold. That was the gold standard of science, according to Aristotle. And then Galileo came along and he says, no, that's not true. He says, I'll show you. So he goes up to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and he drops a ball, two balls, a big one and a small one, a much smaller one, a much bigger one, from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And, of course, with lead balls or iron balls, these heavy balls, there's very little wind resistance. And so they're going to operate as if there weren't any atmosphere at all. So anyway, he drops them at the same time they fall, and they both hit the ground at the same time, contradicting thousands of years of teaching and corroboration of the concept that bigger things fall faster. So this was the first experimental method. And as a result, the professors that all came to watch this returned to their classrooms and continued to teach Aristotelian physics, that the big ball would fall faster, because that's what was in the textbook. That's what they had been teaching. It was incorrect, but this is proof that scientists can blind themselves to truth and logic and facts when presented with information that contradicts their belief system. There's a name for this now. It's called the professor syndrome. It's actually a psychological syndrome, and they have measurements of an enzyme that is exuded in the brain in the nervous system by the endocrine system, and it blocks information that contradicts what the brain is accustomed to seeing. So this is literally called, it's a psychological malady. It's called the professor syndrome. And I always criticize when I really don't go to these anymore because it's so lame, but the American Geophysical Union meetings, and I go to them, and these guys are walking around, and they look like they're, you know, half on drugs, because they're just, you know, they have no inspirational activity in their life. They go to the professors at a university or people that work at NASA, and they go to work and they do the, I mean, they spend decades laboring and belaboring over minutia that most of which is wrong. So anyway, I was thinking the other day, I always tell you that evolution, as it is taught, basically the equivalent of Aristotelian physics or belief systems, and it does get down to physical chemistry and how things work at that level to support the concept of evolution, biological evolution. But I was thinking, I always tell you that it doesn't support what we see. And this begins back at the alleged Big Bang, where there's this massive explosion, and then protons were created and electrons in the first few seconds and all of the antiparticles. And then all of a sudden galaxies form, and then all of a sudden planets form, and then all of a sudden there's monkeys walking around, and then a little while later you. I mean, you know how much missing information there is in this whole story? Talk about a whitewash of misinformation and macro concepts linked together that have no validity, no validation of any kind in the scientific sense. So literally, if you are talking about evolution, there's no scientific evidence for any of this. There's some tertiary things that people interpret as evidence, but it is not direct evidence. Like Galileo, okay, let's look at Galileo. Be real simple, even for people with PhDs out there who are listening that really are convinced that evolution is true, there's some other process going on. And then, by the way, people will say, well, he's a creationist. He believes that God just created this and planted the dinosaur bones in the dirt to fool us. No, there are other possibilities. You okay, Houghty professor who likes to categorize and put thoughts in other people's minds? No, that's not true either. That's the counter story, and that's why they try and make something ridiculous. And there's people out there that say that God put the dinosaur bones to fool us, to lead us astray. Okay, there's other stories out there, okay, that make sense. But let's go back to the idea of evolution. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to take you back to the Big Bang. And we're going to talk about what really would happen if there were a random creation of stuff, particles, atoms, molecules, etc. What would it really look like? What would the universe really look like if what they're telling you about the Big Bang were true? Okay, so that's the main science topic. I'll get there in a minute. But first, I want to jump back to a couple things. Now, for decades, back to my original work, in fact, this goes back to my original papers published in the early 1980s as a result of my book, which was printed in 1979, which summarized my work on many aspects of the electrical nature of the solar system, universe, etc. But I had identified clearly that Jupiter and subordinately the other planets relative to their size, etc., were affecting the solar cycle. In other words, the 11-year solar cycle, which actually there's a 22-year cycle, and then there's other cycles, etc. But they are the primary cycle we look at is the 11-year solar cycle. That's between maximums or between minimums, and that can vary too. We're heading now into a solar minimum. They are counting sunspots, and they believe, some scientists believe, due to magnetic field reversal, etc., of the sun, that we're heading right now into the solar minimum. Okay, be that as it may. But I said right from the beginning that there's clear evidence that the electrical connections between the planets control the cycle of the sun. And the big guy out there, the big kahuna, is Jupiter. That's the primary one. Okay, that's the primary. It has an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. And that's basically the cycle of Jupiter going around the sun. Its orbit is 10 years. But there's other factors, including Saturn, including the other planets, etc. And it turns out to be averaging these together, putting them together, is about and gives you the 11-year solar cycle. So there's no question about that. And so all of a sudden, wouldn't you believe that now a big study, new study, scientists have put this together and from Germany and have published a paper on this topic, but they say it's gravitational tidal waves. It's the differential, it's what the moon does to Earth and the sun does to Earth to give us our tides. These are tidal forces, basically, secondary gravitational forces. And basically what this amounts to is that the in the case of our moon and the Earth, the moon is orbiting around Earth, but the Earth is spinning on its axis every 24 hours. And so every 24 hours plus a little bit, the same point of Earth comes under the moon. And so what happens? The moon is pulling harder on the close side of the Earth, and it's pulling less hard on the far side of the Earth. And that's what causes this bulging, not to mention these spinning of the Earth, centrifugal force, but the tidal waves, in fact, are caused by the Earth spinning underneath the moon. Okay, so those are tidal forces. So what these guys are claiming is that the tidal forces are, in fact, what cause the sun to have its solar cycle. Now, to show how ridiculous this is, gravitational forces are extremely, extremely minimal. They're very small. And the electrical forces are enormous because what happens is when you get alignments, then the cross solar system discharges are reinforced. And this is what, in fact, controls the sun's magnetic field, etc. And these are all things that science cannot explain. And they're trying to couple the sun's magnetic field to gravitational forces, something that simply doesn't work. There's no scientific basis for it at all. There again, some people claim such things, but there's no experimental evidence. There's no theoretical basis. That's what Einstein was working on when he died. It's called the unification of the fields. In other words, to somehow unify the nuclear forces, the short and the weak and the long range, and then the electrical forces and the magnetic forces and gravity, the unification of the fields. There's a topic, it's called the grand unification of fields, and people have been working on this. Real people, real scientists, have been working on this real problem for decades, and nobody has found this. The basis for general relativity, as I explained last week, simply does not exist, that somehow gravity affects light. There's Eddington faked the experiment, and that's the only one that's ever been really done. Everybody else just accepted that, referred to that, and it's kind of like when they criticize Velikovsky. Everybody refers back to Sagan, and Sagan made more mistakes than a monkey trying to, you know, write a computer program. Sagan made horrific errors, and it's still the best-selling science baloney on the planet, is Cosmos series book. It's the best-selling book in terms of books. It's the top-selling science books. It's number six in the world. I think the Gutenberg Bible is number one. And so there's other books that are, have sold more copies than the Cosmos series, but in general books, the Cosmos series book has sold more, but it's full of totally incorrect information that was produced in 1980, before there was really a decent space program even. Okay, so anyway, getting back to the idea that somehow Jupiter creates the solar magnetic field cycle due to gravity is absurd. The effect of Jupiter on the sun at that distance, and literally, apart from this minuscule tidal force, Jupiter and the sun are weightless compared to each other, and that's simply the way it is. Things are weightless. That's the whole point of the space-time continuum of general relativity, which I explained last week is totally correct. That's the correct part of general relativity, the idea that space is curved when you're in a gravitational system, and that basically objects move along curved lines, but they are gravitationless. The equivalent of moving through a space where there's nothing and going in a straight line when you're in the presence of gravitational items or objects, then you would move along a curved line but be weightless also. That's the equivalent straight line of when you're in a gravitational system. And that's what the tensor algebra is all about, the mathematics to deal with space-time and add in that fourth dimension of time. Okay, so that's just, you know, and it's a mathematical structure. Putting in the fourth dimension of time is not anything dramatic in mathematics. You deal with multidimensional systems all the time. Okay, so anyway, getting back to this idea, but the idea is that science cannot progress while they're still talking about this gravitational-only universe. And that's why I chose the term electric universe. If you want to know where that term originated, go to my the summary of my three-part comet paper. And right there it says, distinctly, I define the term electric universe. And then, of course, that's been copied by people who want to, you know, copy my work, etc. But, and then, of course, that's supported by the CIA, who owns NASA, who owns Google, who owns Facebook, etc., and puts money into the groups that copy my work. Why? Because they don't say all of the details. They take my work and distort it into just nonsense, and that's why they want to do that. Then the white horses from NASA can come riding in and say, look at how silly that electric universe stuff is. And of course, they never refer to me. No, this is disinformation at a, you know, right up there at the CIA, just like they're finding now with all of the corruption that they have in the CIA. You know, what they're really afraid of in these investigations, you know, them colluding with Russians, to the CIA colluding with Russia in the Steele dossier and all of that stuff that's coming out now very clearly, that all of us knew all along, but now it's being officially discovered. The idea is that the CIA has been manipulating everything for decades. But what the people high in the CIA are really afraid of is they're going to start to get into the pedophilia stuff, the human trafficking, the cocaine trafficking that they've been doing for decades. You know, it's starting to get into those cracks and crannies, crooks and crannies of the CIA. And that's what the CIA has nothing to do with the United States. They are the police force of the World Bank. And that's why the people go, oh, they should be totally autonomous. Well, they have been, but they shouldn't be if they're part of the United States, but they're not. So that's the double standard that's going on there. Anyway, I diverge. Quick mention on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been up there in space now for 10 years, and it's provided us with nothing. Now, the whole purpose of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is administered at the University of Arizona and by people who are really terrible astronomers, I got to admit this. I have never seen a bunch of more idiotic, incompetent astronomers than at the University of Arizona. Well, no, a lot of them rank right up there, but University of Arizona takes the cake. The point is that they manage the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. The whole purpose of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter was to take extreme high-resolution photographs of the lunar surface. And this is down to the rock and pebble resolution. Why? Because when you're going to the moon, whether it's a manned mission or even an unmanned mission, when you get down to landing on the moon, there should be you want to have as much detail as possible. It's kind of like the bombing raids in World War II. From 13,000, 15,000, or 20,000 feet, Kodak had these cameras with amazing lenses, really good optics, and they could see train cars and details, tracks and bridges and vulnerability points, etc. You needed good data to have accurate bombing. And so if you go into the moon, similarly, from a perspective of optics, you need really, really good data. And what they're presenting, they just presented this on space.com, some amazing pictures from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it's trash. Your cell phone could do better. The resolution is extremely low. So clearly, you can't convince me that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, they put a camera on this thing that would only resolve macro objects. And the resolution is just, it's not there. They take pictures of, for example, they had a couple boosters, apparently, that they crashed into the moon from one of the Apollo, they said the Apollo 13 mission. And so there's some stuff, some dust sprayed out. But come on, with the camera, this is taken from 5 miles away, which is like nose to nose. When you go on Google Earth or Google Map and Google Earth, you can see a bicycle. You could see a tricycle sitting in your backyard. And you could see it from different angles. You could go over to this angle. You could see details, almost to the point of seeing writing on things. This is through 100 miles of atmosphere, or 60 miles of atmosphere, I should say, and all over the world. You can go to any point in the world and find that level of detail. You can see trees and bushes. You can see stuff. If people were standing there, you could see the people. And that's the kind of resolution on a commercial system that's available to the public. The military has the ability to take pictures. You could read a newspaper from outer space with the military-grade satellites. Do you think they're going to put a camera on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that is any less quality? No, it's going to be 100 times better. So clearly they're hiding the data, number one. This what they're putting out there, I call it for candy for the geeks, for the NASA Trekkies. And they all go, ooh, look at the high-resolution pictures. No, this is trash for the public. The public is paying for something, and you're not getting it. But what they're presenting cannot be used for lunar exploration, either manned or unmanned. They cannot, the data that this Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is presenting could not possibly be used in any shape or form for lunar exploration. So either they're lying and presenting trash to the public, and they have real good photos they're not showing you. And that this comes back to the point, too, where they're now showing alleged lunar landing sites, and they have drawings. They're actually drawing with little pencil marks in there where allegedly the lunar lander went, and et cetera. Anyway, I could go on and on. The commentary is simply that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, after 10 years, has provided us, the public, with nothing. And literally, it has no value in the scientific sense. Okay, just a quick note on the population of Nigeria. That's a country, West Africa, right around where that knob of Africa comes off, where the hurricanes come rolling out of there. That's where the storm systems leave Africa that come out into the Atlantic to form the hurricanes during hurricane season. But they have, to the east and south is Cameroon, to the north is Niger, but 50% of that high-density population of Western Africa, 50% of that, the population is in Nigeria. Probably about a decade ago, they started to have explosive population growth. The country currently has 200 million people and will easily more than double in the next 10 years. It'll probably triple in population up to around 600 million people. But with this, and this is with people that already exist, this is not projections. The issue is that as the youth population, which is the largest youth population in the world today, as it reaches maturity in the next number of years, they're going to have 100,000 new jobs every week. That's how fast these people are going to be so-called graduating into adulthood. These are tremendous, tremendous numbers that say that you in the United States, with the great economic growth that's going on today, unbelievable economic growth, where you have, say, 400,000 jobs created in the last couple years. These are real jobs, long-term, like manufacturing jobs, etc. 400,000 created in the last couple years in the United States, which has a booming economy today. But to imagine somehow having to come up with 100,000 new jobs per week for a number of years is just, it's just beyond comprehension. So the question is, what on earth are these countries going to do? What are the youth going to do? And I'll tell you also that there are other populations in the, especially Latin American countries, that have similar population growth. They're dealing with 2 to 3% growth per year. And that is, that's a formula that you're hitting the knee. I've talked about this before, in the exponential growth curve of population. And once you hit that, then you go India. You go, in a sense, China syndrome or India syndrome. And I'm not talking about nuclear plants melting down through the earth because of the tremendous heat. I'm talking about population, China syndrome, India syndrome. You start getting up to that point where in another 5 to 10 years, you start crossing the billion mark. For a small country in Western Africa, in 20 years to start approaching the billion mark in population. Remember, I talked about I've talked about this in my paid cast. There are some sections on overpopulation, but there are two types of resource use. In the third world countries, they're not using in that country. Of course, the other developed countries are in those countries extracting diamonds and minerals and oil and other kinds of resources, but taking them away. But the local people are left with nothing. They don't get anything from the benefit. Sierra Leone and all of these other countries do not benefit from all of the riches that exist in those countries because the World Bank long ago went in there and gave them development loans that they couldn't possibly pay back. And when they couldn't pay back the loans, this was the formula. If you're not familiar with this, read the Confessions of an Economic Hitman book. It tells you all about this, and we everybody that has a brain knows about this, how this works. The World Bank, the IMF, goes in, gives loans. The country cannot pay it back. They default. They say, okay, well, we got to bring in all these international corporations to help you out. They pile more loans on the country, and then they rape the resources and take them away. That's the formula that's been going on. That was what they were doing in the United States until a guy named Trump came along and reversed it all. Okay, so anyway, the issue is that the third world country use of resources is different. They're using the meager surface resources of these countries to support populations in, like, using wood for cooking. And this is like going out and gathering brush or small trees. Used to be big trees. Now there's no more big trees. Now they're going to the smaller trees, down to brush. And of course, animals and birds and things like that cannot exist without the bio, you know, the plant life. So literally, you know, they overgraze it with cattle, etc. And, you know, misuse of water. Then they have flooding because they've cut down all the plants and literally destroy the surface of the earth until it becomes a desert. So this is desertification. So my point is that the first world countries, people talk about overuse of resources. That's being done by the first world countries, including China, which is all over the world taking resources for its huge economy to support it. But none of this can last. None of this is going to last forever. It's sometime in this century the human race is going to run out of resources. And the next thing I'll be talking about is the failure of fracking. I'll be talking about that in a minute. But I wanted to just mention this topic because I hit on population, overpopulation in the world and the effects. But Nigeria is a special case. Now, there's a country north of Nigeria called Niger, which is bigger in land area, and it only has 23 million people compared to 200 million. Nigeria has literally 10 times more people than Niger, which is a country just north of it. But still, 20 million people in a small country like that is a lot of people, and they're all experiencing this exponential population growth. So be that as it may. Okay, on to the topic of fracking. This is something that nobody is talking about, and now the reports are starting to come out from the Oklahoma, Texas, and other locations that are fracking, the North Dakota fracking. And this is not something that's in the public news. It's not going to be. It's not going to get there. Let's look at the process of fracking. What do? You put explosives down in the ground, and you pump water down in the ground, and then you hit the explosives. What does that do? That jars the ground, that anything in there, especially for natural gas or oil, it puts pressure, and it makes it easy then to extract those minerals. So the natural gas especially is forced out of the ground, and then you have to be there to capture all of this, and because if not, it's just going to go in the atmosphere and go up to the upper atmosphere and leave and go away. So you have to capture this, and in a lot of these fields, they are not able to capture all of this, but they capture a percentage of it, and then they ship it off to places like New Orleans and other places where they're now developing super tanker transportation for natural gas. And if you've seen these ships, they look like an oil tanker, but they have three big globes that set down in them, and this is pressurized, in other words, liquid natural gas. LNC it is called, or LNG, I'm sorry, liquid natural gas. And this is being exported from the United States in huge quantities because of fracking. Now, what does fracking do? It gets the quantity out quickly, but leaves the area so that you cannot continue this fracking process. The second time you go back and try and do fracking the second time, you get a lot less. So it's not productive from, you know, from that point of view. But even the first time, fracking is not an economic process. It's being subsidized. And so basically, we're in a very short period of time, we're going to exhaust our natural gas resources. Now, you cannot do fracking under, for example, the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of natural gas that's coming up with the oil that's coming up out of the Gulf of Mexico. So that's a longer-term source. But when you're doing fracking on land, then you're exhausting those resources very quickly. Okay, so I want to keep moving here. Let me see. Yeah, I've covered the other topics. Now I want to jump into this. By the way, this is a mini lecture of what you would get in my paid cast. I expand on this a lot more in my paid cast in the educational system. But I want people to get a feeling here for what is in my paid cast, the value, so that you go and sign up for the paid cast and get a lot more of this. Okay, so what? Here's the question. What would a truly random evolutionary universe look like? Let me repeat that. Okay, so we are told by the high priests of science, the high priests that decide our future, etc., of science, they decide that the universe began in a Big Bang. And once again, the principal experimental data that they use to convince you of this is, number one, the microwave background radiation. And that is something that's measured. They put satellites outside of the atmosphere, and they look all around, and there is a microwave signature that comes, and it's about 3 degrees. Microwaves are very cold, so it would indicate a 3-degree temperature in the microwaves. The equivalent, they talk about temperature, and you can translate that to wavelength. Okay, but what are they really looking at? They're looking at the dust cloud that surrounds our solar system. They have not put out a microwave sensor outside of that region, and even to date, only the Voyager spacecraft have gotten that far, where they're actually starting to sense the intergalactic wind, which is in a different direction from our solar system wind. So even they are not out beyond the point where you could look, if you had microwave sensors, into the vast universe. But if you got out there, you would not see the microwave background radiation. So that's point number one. They're mistaken. Point number two is the redshift. They claim that everything is redshifted in the universe, all the galaxies and quasars, and that implies that everything is expanding. Number two, that is false, because the redshifts are related to the induced electric dipole redshift, which is provable in a laboratory. That's my work. That's my defined definition of the effect of light caused by the non-uniform electric fields around fusion-based objects and also objects that are discharging the capacitors of these fusion-based objects. So number two, the two main reasons for believing in a Big Bang are totally incorrect. But I'm going to give you a third, more subtle reason for believing or for not believing the so-called Big Bang. Okay, so let's take a random universe, and this is what they propound. They go, oh, this was all random. It all just happened. Boom. There's no God. There's no design. And that's the point they want to get to. Atheist religion. They don't want a God in there. They don't want any creator. They want to just, oh, this just happened all by itself. So let's take a look at it. Let's go back to the Big Bang. And so there's this big, massive explosion. In a random universe, the protons would all be different. They would be different masses. They would have different charges. They'd be different physical size. The wavelength size of the protons would all be different. There would not be such a thing as a defined proton that we could measure all their properties. All the protons would be different. Equally, all the electrons would be different. They would be different sizes. They would have different masses. They would have different charges. Everything would be different because, according to the high priests of science, this is a random process. And that's what you would get in a random process. So now let's make a simple atom, a hydrogen atom, a proton and an electron, simplest atom there is. Let's make one of those with our random universe, Big Bang, explosion. Okay, so over here, you have a proton that's a certain size and an electron that's a certain size, but their charges don't match. Because in a random universe, hey, things aren't always the same. They're not nice and uniform. Because remember, there's nobody designing this. There was no God. There was no creator. There was no design. It's random. Okay, so now you got your hydrogen atom. The only problem is when you create another hydrogen atom over here, the proton is a different size. The charge is a different size. The electron, excuse me, is a different size, different mass, and different charge. So they're not neutral at the end. A hydrogen atom in our universe, which has a designer, which has an infinitely great, beautiful design, the protons are all the same. You can go to the far side of the universe. You can measure the hydrogen atom properties at the far side of the universe and every place in between, and they're all the same. That is a design. That is a very critical design. All protons are the same. All neutrons are basically a proton with an electron combined, giving you a neutral particle with a mass that's a slightly different than the combined mass of the electron and the proton due to relativistic mass conversion. Okay, so anyway, in the Big Bang, High Priest, random Big Bang universe, the neutrons may not be neutral. They would have a slight positive charge or a slight negative charge based on which proton combined with which electrons. Because remember, it's all random. Now let's build a water molecule, the basis of all life as we know it. Okay, now you got two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen. H2O is the water molecule. The hydrogens are different. They have a different kind of charge. They have a different, the angle of the water, which is critical to many processes, the angle and the vibration modes of the water molecule are going to be different for every water molecule. Every water molecule is going to be different. It's going to have a slight charge. One of the tremendous things of a water molecule is its internal dipole. That's what makes water very effective at doing things like corroding things and destroying things, etc. You put something in water, it's not going to be there long. I don't care if it's steel or wood, your foot, whatever. It's not going to be there long because water attacks everything. But that's part of its function. That gives it some beneficial properties when it's inside of you, which you're made up of primarily water. So your organs are designed to hold that water. Okay. So anyway, but in the High Priest Big Bang universe, every water molecule is different because it's random. Okay, now let's look at evolution of plants and animals and DNA. Let's try and build a nucleotide molecule, which is the basic building block of life, which then is built up with phosphates to make DNA and RNA, our basic building structure of life. And you're doing this with carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen atoms, and some phosphates and some other molecules mixed in for glue. But every one of those oxygen, carbon, etc., every carbon atom is different. So how do you make, say, a hydrocarbon protein and a molecule, base molecule for that is necessary, or enzymes, etc., when every carbon atom in there is different? Or let's still get away from organic. Let's go to a diamond. Let's go to a diamond. In the world of the creator designer universe, which we live in, the diamond is built up of carbon atoms that create a crystalline structure. And it's very hard, it's very durable, the covalent bonding is very complete, So it makes diamond literally the hardest material available based on the carbon atom. Well, let's go to the high priest Big Bang universe. The diamonds would not have nice fissures. You couldn't take a chisel and chop and make a split along a facet of a diamond because it would be all kiddywampus. Because you got molecules and carbon atoms which are all different. They're all different. So you're not going to have diamonds the way we see diamonds today. The reason diamonds are diamonds is because all the carbon atoms in that diamond are exactly the same. But in the High Priest Big Bang Theorem, kiddywampus universe that has no designer and no design and no consistency, diamonds as we know them would not exist. It'd be a mess. Or how about, let's see. Here's a good one. How about copper, which we use for conductors? Or aluminum is used secondarily, but let's just go to copper. Okay, so now you have a conductor in which the conducting base is not consistent. The copper atoms that are in the structure, in the amorphous structure of the wire, some of them are charged, and so to different degrees. And so now you're going to have an electron trying to move through this, and it's going to be seeing things that are protons or atoms there that'll be slightly positively charged, some slightly negatively charged. And the consistent flow of energy through a wire is going to be different. It's not going to work the same. It's not going to be as good a conductor as it would be if you were dealing with a designer universe. Okay, so these are some basic examples. Now, if you get up to, let's get up to the higher level of evolution of people, or the alleged evolution of people. How do you get consistency amongst the species of bisymmetry? In other words, you have two eyes, they're symmetrical. You have two nostrils, your teeth are symmetrical. Your mouth is symmetrical around the center. Let's go to a universe that does not have symmetrical atoms for the DNA, for the DNA structure in the matching DNA when it splits and it reforms and it creates all of the structure in the DNA. Let's imagine the High Priest Big Bang universe with everything random. Well, when that DNA guy splits, the carbon atom matching the carbon atom over here, the one on the left and the one on the right, don't match. I mean, boys and girls, let's get some adults back in the room here. Sit down, put on your seatbelt. The Big Bang does not work. It's fantasy science. They can write all the equations, fill all of the peer-reviewed journals you want. Fill them all. Fill them up more than complete. Take a universe that is purely gravitational. It doesn't work. It's a sterile universe in which nothing happens. There's no weather. There are no clouds. There's no lightning. There's no rain. Everything is sterile, a sterile environment. Let's just take a look at the plasma discharge comet model and how that mixes in with this. The everything does it all by itself, Big Bang, Carl Sagan evolution universe, has to have something like plate tectonics. That's why they had to grab on so hard to plate tectonics. But how does a planet have plates that just kind of slide around? And they have these amazing textbook videos and drawings about, they say, oh, this Panea, this original continent that had all the continents, and then they just kind of all moved around. Wait a minute, boys and girls. Where is the force that created the movement making continents, entire continents, move around? And it's like, well, it looks good in the textbook. Must be true. They said it in the textbook. Must be true. A lot of scientists in geology agree on it. Must be true. Well, get down to the physics. That's why I criticize geologists in scientists and meteorologists is they're very poorly trained in physics. They possibly took physics 101. It was too hard for them. They stopped, and that was the last course they had, and that's the last time they thought about it. But how do you take entire continents and move them around and then push them hard enough so that 1,000 miles to the inner part of the continent, mountains rise and you have this massive amount of rock that you have to push up to 20 to 30,000 feet, you know, 6 miles up into the air, this massive amount of rock, and nobody blinks an eye. Wait a minute. How do you lift off of this all this rock by continents moving in subduction over here? It doesn't work. It simply does not work. But let's look at the plasma discharge comet model. If you did not have comets that are big comets coming through the solar system and occasionally having close passages with the existing planets, here's what Earth would look like today. Earth would be a perfectly round ball because in its molten state, when it formed, it was molten, so self-gravity pulls the solid materials into a perfect sphere, no mountains, and as it would cool, and as the process of water, atmosphere, whatever came along, you would have a perfect layer of water over this billiard ball smooth planet. And so that would be your planet. All planets would look like this. There would be no mountains. There would be no valleys for the oceans to fill in. The Earth would not be egg-shaped. It wouldn't have any of the properties. And if there were life of any kind, it would be down in the oceans. You would never have intelligent beings that lived on land. It would be really, really difficult. Let's take this one step further. What if Earth were in that condition, where it was a smooth billiard ball surface with a layer of water and an atmosphere above that? Imagine the fish, according to standard science, evolving into intelligent beings that then would have the ability to study outer space and then build spaceships to go into outer space. You know, the sea creatures over, you know, the millions and billions of years or whatever that they've been in the ocean have not progressed an iota. The shark is the exact same shark as it was, you know, 100,000, a million years ago. They have not progressed. What's the difference with people living on land? Well, first of all, they can see the stars. You know, a fish or a whale jumping out of water for 10 seconds does not give you a lot of time to really study the stars or wonder what caused them or to create the fusion process or to understand the solar cycle or solar wind or Van Allen belts or build spacecraft to go up into space and, you know, understand vacuum of outer space. No, the fish have not done well. Real well in that area, if you haven't noticed. No, they don't do real well. So you have to have a dry land where the people can prosper, the intelligent beings, we call them people, can prosper and therefore look at the stars and go, hey, you know, look at those stars. And then all of a sudden you get a guy like Kepler comes along and Halley. And they go, oh, you know, those things are way out there. Those comets are not in the atmosphere like Aristotle talked about. They're way out there. They're in orbit around the sun. Huh, what's with that? You know, we've been taught for 2,000 years that the comets were fire in the sun, another Aristotelian scientific fact, which was wrong. And so anyway, okay, so then, but the idea is you have these, you know, intelligent beings can look out the stars and realize, okay, they're way out there. What's between us and them? Can we go travel there? People want to travel. You know, if there's as soon as people could make boats, they would travel. As soon as people had camels, they would travel. People are prone to go places and seek out new things. People have that explorative sense. It's part of their being is to go out and explore and find new things and take advantage of things that, you know, new places they go to and go on vacation. But, you know, to look up at the stars and wonder about them, you're not going to build a spacecraft to go out in outer space if you don't see the stars and know that they're there. And that's one of the things I've criticized, not criticized, but made note, that if you were a being and you lived in the inner galaxy where there were, say, in a star cluster, where you had eternal daytime, you'd never see the stars. You would not know that there was a whole galaxy. Those beings in there may never get off their own planet. Or it might take a while for them to, you know, get off their own planet and finally get out to the point where they can see past their star cluster. But they got 24/7 light from all around. But anyway, back to comets. If you did not have close passages of comets, big comets by planets like Earth, we would not have mountains. We would not have an oblong Earth. We would not have dry land. We would not have a place for intelligent beings to create and prosper and have agriculture and have extra time to where they can look up in the stars and create things. And then they create wagons that go behind horses. And then some guy gets an idea about building a motor and creating an automobile that uses petroleum, which you find in the ground, which is there because of the comet passing by. Yeah. Look at the universe that they're presenting to you. It doesn't work. It does not account for anything that you see. And so in going back to the High Priest Big Bang universe, it's ludicrous. It doesn't work. What you have to do in here, in the beginning of the process, is you have to realize that this universe has a grand design. It is intricately designed to work in many different aspects. The macro part, the comets coming by to create the mountains, so you have in the oblong-shaped Earth, so you have dry continents so that people can live there and develop. I mean, that's an essential part of our planet. Anyway, okay, well, enough of that. But we live in a universe that has a grand design and a grand designer, and one of the most primary basic things that you can do is simply observe this and give thanks to the Creator, because you're pretty important, because you're one of the minuscule parts of material in the universe that has a being that can actually look out and see it. All the rest of the planets and stars, it's just inert matter. It's just going through a physical process. So the understanding that you are very special, and even though we think there's a lot of people on planet Earth, 7-8 billion, I think there's 10 billion, you know, that's still a pretty small amount of matter dedicated to intelligent, well, so-called intelligent beings. I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. Remember to go to my webpage. I don't have sponsors. I don't get government grants. I don't have a $21.5 billion budget from NASA. I sell water filters, and that's one of the ways I make money. So if you like, go to my water filters. They're the best ones on the planet. JMCCSCI.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.